Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the Public Affairs Council for our webinar briefing on the rise of China and its effects on global business. I'm Dasha Venticheva, and I'm the manager of the Council's Global Public Affairs Practice. And today, I will be joined by Damien Ma from the Paulson Institute and Scott Kronick from Ogilvy Asia Pacific as our speakers. And they will be sharing their perspectives on the economic outlook for the region, as well as what it means for public affairs. This is a briefing that we have on an annual basis, so this is our update for the year, and it is also the last international webinar of the year, so we're happy to end it on such an interesting topic. China certainly generates a lot of headlines, especially recently, especially in regard to the U.S.-China relationship, so I hope that we will also be touching on that with our experts today. As always, our participants have the ability to pose questions to Damien and Scott through the online chat platform. You will see a chat box located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, so I encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity to ask about public affairs trends and how your company might be affected. Damien will start off our presentation, and he will be discussing more the political and economic trends that are affecting China, and Scott will be giving us an overview of public affairs in the region as well as trends that he and his team are seeing. So to tell you a little bit more about our presenters, Damien Ma is a fellow and associate director of the think tank Macro Polo at the Paulson Institute, focused on investment and policy programs, as well as various research projects and activities. He is the co-author and editor of several books on China and currently serves as an adjunct lecturer at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Previously, Damien was a China and Mongolia senior analyst at Eurasia Group, where he specialized in analyzing the intersection between Chinese policies and markets, with a particular focus on energy and commodities, industrial policy, elite politics, U.S.-China relations, and social policies. Prior to joining Eurasia Group, he was a manager of publications at the U.S.-China Business Council in Washington, D.C., and also worked at H-Line Ogilvy in Beijing, where he served major multinational clients. So we do have some overlap in the background of our speakers. And Scott Kronick is the chief executive of PR and Influence for Asia with Ogilvy, and he has been with the company for over 30 years. Today, Scott is responsible for the leadership and management of Ogilvy's public relations highly awarded Asia-Pacific network, which covers 30 offices in 15 countries. It is the largest and most influential international public relations network in Asia and the largest region in the company's global network. During his time in Asia, Scott has been a major driving force behind the growth of the network throughout the region and was instrumental in establishing Ogilvy Public Relations in China in 1995, overseeing the opening of offices in Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. The business in China now consists of more than 500 employees and regularly ranks as the leading international agency in the market. Scott was appointed president and CEO of Ogilvy Asia Pacific in 2014, where he advises both corporate and various government bodies as clients. He is an expert in the industry as well as the region, and we are lucky to have him and Damien join us today. So without further ado, I will hand things off to Damien, who will begin our webinar presentation. Damien, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Dasha, and good morning, everyone. It's great to be on this webinar with my colleague Scott. It's also a perfectly opportune time to be talking about China, as I'm sure you've all been paying attention to the back and forth with the United States and China negotiating a deal or no deal. I'm not going to be talking that much about those particular issues. I'll leave that to Scott and his team. I'm going to focus predominantly on what's happening in the Chinese economy, or really the Chinese political economy. And I think understanding that more deeply, certainly matters in terms of thinking about how, in terms of how China faces the United States, because what happens in the domestic economy obviously manifests itself in its negotiations and its tactics with the United States. And again, this is also a very terrific time to be talking about the Chinese economy. As some of you may know, this is the 40th anniversary of the reform and opening up. the huge experiment that a former leader, Deng Xiaoping, launched in 1978 that basically created modern China. The China you know today was really began in 1978. And it was because of this reform and opening effort. And so it's a good time to take stock of where the Chinese economy is and where it is going, which hence the title of The Chinese Economy in Transition. And this, to me, is probably one of the most significant economic events of this particular century. So let me set the scene a little bit. I'm going to start off a bit broad at about 10,000 feet just to set the scene, and then I'm going to go through and gradually get more kind of micro and talk a bit more about some of the challenges and opportunities in the Chinese economy. So we all know that the Chinese economy is huge, but I think this chart really illustrates just how significantly it has grown. The data doesn't start from 1978 per se, but it's basically the last 35 to 40 years of economic trajectory for the Chinese economy. I didn't bring 2017 data, but if you brought that in, China's, you know, roughly a $13 trillion economy, and that number, 35%, is actually closer to 40% of the global economy. So you're looking at roughly 200 countries in the world. Two countries, the United States and China, make up 40% of the global economy. It is absolutely enormous. People make fun of sort of the G2 idea of between U.S. and China, but when it comes to sort of global output, there's really no competition after the U.S. and China. For all intents and purposes, unless short of catastrophic slowdown, China is still poised to overtake the United States in absolute terms over the next 10 or 12 years. And just to bring that a little bit in sort of comparative context, what's been happening over the last 35 years is really, broadly speaking, not just versus U.S. and China, but globally, is what you would consider economic convergence. I have three of the BRIC countries up there. I didn't put Russia up there. But you look at, Brazil, India, China versus Japan and the United States, the red line being China, really took off around 1990, mid-1990s, and it has, really been nonstop since then. Obviously, the enormous growth came when China entered the WTO in 2001, and you see that reflected in the red line. And interesting enough, I want to make this quick point here. If you look at the second gray line below the United States, that's Japan. Japan peaked around 1995, and then it kind of just declined and stagnated. And this is something to think about, and I'm going to come back to that point a little bit later, but I just wanted to show you a little bit. Japan in 1995 was about 70% of the U.S. economy. Okay, so China, $12.9 trillion, $13 trillion. China today is roughly about 65% of the U.S. economy. So right around where Japan was, where Japan began to stumble and stagnate. So there is some concern that that if China does not undertake some fundamental structural changes, which is what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the, for the second half of this presentation, is that China could end up like a Japan where it kind of stagnates and never really quite reaches its full potential. But I'm going to go through some reasons where I think China is not really like Japan in 1995, but certainly there is a risk that China becomes a much larger version of Japan. And another data that I think is interesting, you probably have heard a lot of, there's been a lot of tensions and problems between mainland China and Hong Kong. One of the reasons here is, as you can see, 1997. Why did I pick 1997? That was the eve of Hong Kong's formal handover to mainland China. At that time, Hong Kong was 20% of China's GDP. 20 years later, it is only 2.5% of mainland China's GDP. So that clearly affects Hong Kong's sort of status in terms of the overall Chinese economy, and that, I think, is underlying some of the tensions that's been happening between mainland and China. But it is interesting to see, a lot of the economic gravity is really getting pulled into mainland China, not Hong Kong anymore, even though Hong Kong is still a great place for a lot of financial firms and, headquarters for multinationals, et cetera. But in terms of economic weight, mainland China is now sort of the name of the game, so to speak. And you've heard a lot about exports, and like I said, I think Scott and others will talk more about the trade side and the tensions, but this is the picture. This is kind of the macro picture you're looking at. China has really built itself into an export machine. In absolute volumes, it basically overshadows all the other major export countries. And the reason I put Japan and Germany up there is that they're also very large surplus export-oriented countries. And China is basically, China is basically Japan plus Germany in terms of its total absolute export volume. So it's really built up an export machinery and ecosystem. But I'm also going to come back and say why China actually today is not really an export-driven economy anymore, despite the fact that in absolute volume it is by far it's a huge export volume, so to speak. A big shift right now that you're seeing is that China is no longer just an exporter of things. You know, a lot of many Americans probably think of China as, you see the Made in China label, that sort of our individual interaction with China, Made in China products. But China is increasingly an investor. And you've heard a lot about China, China investing in emerging markets, developing countries like in Africa and Latin America. But what's interesting, of course, is China's investment in the United States and also OECD countries in Europe. This is a project we've been doing at our think tank where we mapped out and tracked every individual Chinese investment in the United States. You can see the numbers to the right side. This is a snapshot of the current reality. So you're looking at Chinese investments have created 114,000 jobs. In the United States, contributing roughly $56 billion to the national GDP. Of course, these numbers are not that significant yet, but you have to think about the fact that a few years ago, this was basically zero. If you think about, again, using Japan as an analogy, Japan's, four or five times the FDI in the United States, and China is just getting started. Now, there are some political reasons why this may not persist, and I'm sure I get to that in the Q&As, but this is sort of what the current reality is in terms of Chinese FDI, and they're increasingly deploying capital into advanced economies rather than just emerging countries, emerging markets in Latin America and Africa. Now, sort of for why the transition is happening, this is kind of sets the macro scene. China is just naturally slowing down. If you look at it, Chinese GDP growth actually peaked all the way back in 2007, 14.2%, which was extremely rapid growth. But then, of course, the financial crisis hit, and ever since then, they've really been slowing down. And part of it is deliberate, and I'll go into some of the reasons why it's not deliberate, but essentially China is never going back to double-digit growth anymore. And the top leaders recognize that. They don't want double-digit growth anymore. We're looking at, 5 to 6% growth for the next 10 or 15 years, and that is, frankly, okay, because China is a much bigger economic base now, so you can actually grow slower. But basically, China is no longer a kind of, fast growth story. It's really about a transition story. In case you are not aware, the Chinese leadership under Xi Jinping, and actually even before Xi Jinping, they've set these very long-term goals. This is why a lot of people think China has a, long-term vision, because they like to see, 20, 30, 50 years in advance. So these are kind of the two 100-year goals that the current president Chinese president Xi Jinping has been fixated on. Why these two dates? Well, 2020, 2021 is roughly 100 years from the founding of the Communist Party of China, which was founded in 1921. And why 2049? Well, 2049 will be 100 years from the formation of the modern People's Republic of China in 1949. So they're looking at 100 years from the formation of the Communist Party and 100 years from the founding of the country. 2049 essentially is, mid-century, where China believes it will be, return to its, rightful place in the world, greatness, high-income country. But who knows? That's 30, 40 years down the line, 30 years down the line. But if you just look at the 2020 goal, which is only 2 years away, they are almost certainly going to meet it, because in terms of just pure economic output, To reach their goal, it implies 6.5% average growth from 2016 to 2020. We're already in 2018, and they've been above 6.5%, so they're most likely going to meet that goal. The big problem of going from 2020 to 2049 is so-called the middle income trap. Some of you may have heard about it. Basically, what happens is that it turns out to be really difficult to move from middle income status to a high income, advanced, wealthy country status. And you can see some of the statistics there. 13 countries have only done it since 1960, and about half of them happen to be so-called Asian tigers, you know, places like Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and so on. And a lot of Latin American countries like Brazil still remain stuck in the middle income trap. And China is sort of in that, I didn't highlight it here, but China is actually in right smack dab in the middle of that square where the middle income trap is. And middle income is about $10,000 per capita GDP, which is roughly where China is. But to go from 10,000 to 20, 25,000, where you become an advanced wealthy country, that is really, really hard. That requires some fundamental shifts in the economy. And that's why China understands that. It's just, can they actually achieve that transition to go from a middle to a high-income country? There are some positive signs. One way to do that is they need to shift the structural composition of their GDP. As I think many of you know, that China has predominantly been driven by investment, heavy industry, steel, cement, all the things that China now has overcapacity in that they're exporting to the rest of the world, including the United States. That's sort of the gray line that you see up there. It's always been around 50% of GDP. It's huge. But in recent years, what you're seeing is that the services have gone up, and it's actually surpassed industry. So this is what economists call rebalancing. It's happening gradually, but it is actually happening, and that I take as a positive sign that China is moving away from industry, and which has led to a lot of problems with, pollution, environment. Services is where China needs to go, and they are moving in the right direction, albeit gradually. And just breaking it that down a little bit further, in terms of the contribution to growth, remember what I said earlier, that China is a huge export power in absolute value and volume. But if you look at exports, net exports as a contribution to growth, it's actually much, much smaller than people think it is. So oftentimes you'll hear that China is an export-oriented economy. Well, China is not an export-oriented economy. China is an investment-driven economy, which is the blue bar, capital formation. And that bar has to go down a lot. That bar has to be reduced a lot more. The orange bar, consumption, is what really needs to go up, domestic consumption, household consumption. Compared to the U.S., U.S. is something like 70-80% driven by consumption. So it's really the battle between, reducing investment, fixed asset investment, and really shifting wealth to the household so that they can continue to consume more and more. But the notion that China is export-driven is just no longer true. And this is also why the currency is no longer an issue. If you remember back in the mid-2000s, currency was the predominant issue, tension between U.S. and China. They were manipulating their currency. They were pegging their currency to the U.S. dollar. And you can see that in this chart. In 2008, when the financial crisis hit, the currency was basically flat because they went back to a peg to the U.S. dollar, and then they basically let go of the peg in 2010. And ever since then, the market, the currency has actually behaved much more market-based. There's been a lot less intervention, and in part because what's happening in the export sector. China is just no longer as dependent on the export sector for growth than it was in the 2000s. And a little notice paper from the U.S. Fed Reserve actually basically said that Chinese yuan on a day-to-day basis looks very much like a free-floating currency. So, yes, there are still occasional interventions by the Central Bank of China, but for the most part, it's behaving much more, based on market movements, which is you're seeing both depreciation and appreciation. And so currency, again, is no longer an issue when it comes to U.S. and China. Partly that's driven by changes in the domestic economy. But what is the problem now for the domestic economy, as some of you may have also heard, is debt or leverage. Part of that was a legacy of the massive stimulus that China launched post-financial crisis around 2008, 2009. They're still working their way through that. And there's been other mini-stimulus since then that's really added to the debt. You see a headline number of 261%. That sounds like a lot. It isn't. U.S. debt to GDP is actually higher, so is Japan's. But China, again, is not at the level of Japan or United States in terms of, you know, per capita wealth. So this debt can be a source of risk. A lot of people kind of think that this could lead to a financial crisis of the sort that we saw in the United States. I think that's a misreading of the Chinese economy. So a lot of this debt is on sort of state-owned enterprises or local governments, and that is fully backstopped by the government, by the state. So, you know, the losses will be written off by the state. So it's not gonna happen in the same way that we had the financial crisis in the United States. But it is a serious issue, because when you're servicing debt, you're not making profit, and so you know that tends to drag down growth. But they've actually made some progress. If you see kind of the last 3 years, they've been on a very austerity campaign. They've really tried to tackle the debt, deleverage, and although it's still growing in absolute terms, relative terms, it's actually been plateauing or stabilizing. The one concern I'll highlight here is that the dark purple line here is dark gray bar is non-financial corporate debt. What's possibly concerning is that there's been some growth in household debt, which is the light gray bar, and that is potentially concerning because household debt is not backstopped by the government, and a lot of that has to do with property purchases. So that could make it potentially a bit more risky if that continues to grow. But again, the Chinese government is aware of that problem, and they're trying to deal with the household leverage issue as well. And this is just I'll probably skip this pretty quickly, but this is just a Morgan Stanley projection of sort of the three different scenarios. I think we're probably more or less along the base case, so that they're slowly bending the curve to have that kind of plateau. And so they've made some progress, and that this debt issue will continue to be a focus of the Chinese government for the next 2 or 3 years. And one other major issue when it comes to reform and economic performance is the battle between the state-owned enterprises, the state sector versus the private sector. That's a huge source of problem both for the domestic Chinese economy and also for foreign firms, because foreign firms keep on, you know, going up against massive state-backed SOEs with a lot of subsidies. And you can see that in the last few years, this is just industrial firms. These are not all SOEs, but just SOEs in the industrial firm. But you can see their profitability versus private sector. That's partly because of Chinese government subsidies and helping them through some rough times in the last few years. But, you know, the results are actually pretty incredible for the SOEs. This is a huge this is a sour point domestically, and I think a lot of private sector Chinese private sector firms are complaining to the government that they're not getting their fair share, and that the government is helping the state sector too much under President Xi Jinping. And again, this is a huge source of problem between not just Chinese private sector firms but also foreign private firms and Chinese SOEs. This is one area where I think reform has not progressed enough, and there's a lot of political reasons for that. I won't get into them now. We can probably take them up in a Q&A, but this is a big problem. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about innovation, because for China to escape the middle-income trap, they got to do a couple things. You know, the formulas are well-known. You got to be able to focus on innovation. You got to be able to focus on capital efficiency. You got to make the economy much more efficient, and the way to do that is through, obviously, technology and innovation. And so China does have a lot of huge, tech companies. They're called BATX, X is Xiaomi, which is sort of the Apple of China. They make some of the high-end mobile phones. I would also put Huawei up there, but Huawei is not technically part of this grouping. So kind of like GAFA in the United States, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, China has its own grouping. And just look at Tencent is obviously, one of the biggest tech companies in China right now. Their market cap is bigger than Sweden. And Alibaba, I think most people have heard of. But those companies, they haven't quite globalized yet, but they're trying to. And so these are kind of the crown jewels of the Chinese tech scene. And they all happen to be private for the most part. And here, we often, I think, bring up this notion of whether different types of governments, different political systems mean different outcomes in terms of innovation. Well, I just want to pose this provocative question here, whether that actually matters when it comes to innovation. If you just look at this ranking of, obviously, all the U.S. companies are still top, at the top, with the exception of Tencent and Alibaba, have made it into the top 10. But a lot of these companies happen to be Chinese companies. And so it's not entirely clear that just purely thinking about, political regimes, political systems, somehow innovation doesn't flourish. We can get into some of the reasons why tech innovation has actually flourished in China. But I'll just kind of pose that question here and let you guys think about that a little bit. And finally, I will just end by saying that in the Chinese political system, you should never underestimate anniversaries. I began my remarks by saying this is the 40th anniversary of reform and opening up, and I think in just next week or the week after, President Xi will make a big speech, and we'll see what he says. That could, again, be market positive or market negative, depending on how he frames it. But a lot of these anniversaries, the reason I bring them up, they're almost like action-forcing events. They are the events around which major policies could be announced. And, so I just want to put that out there because the Chinese political system puts a lot of emphasis on anniversaries. So around them, they tend to announce major reform policies, other major openings, whether it's a U.S. and China deal. All those things could happen around these big anniversaries. And I think, President Xi is also very well aware that he's 2 or 3 years out from his first 100-year goal. And to achieve that, they are actually going to have to double down on a lot of reforms that they laid out 3 or 4 years ago that I think by most observations they haven't made as much progress on in the last in the first 5 years. So the hope is that in the next 2 to 3 years, 4 or 5 years, that they're really going to double down on those reforms. And that's really the only way for China to actually achieve some of its 200-year goals. And I'm going to end right there and turn it over to Scott.
Thanks, Damian. And thank you to everyone at the Public Affairs Council for giving us this opportunity. I am just going to dive right into it. I'm going to give you a little bit of a inside China perspective on what we're seeing. I've lived in China and greater China area for 27 years and in Beijing for the last 24 years. So we'll give you a perspective on what we're seeing there. I'm delighted to say that I'm in New Orleans right now with the Xi'an government. We do work for the Xi'an government in terms of just their kind of travel and tourism and also getting some destinations, some investment into Xi'an. And we're here at the New York Times Future Cities Forum where the Xi'an government is presenting here as the only Chinese city. And it's exciting for me because in my 24 years of working in China, we started out just working exclusively with multinational companies. And today we're about 50-50, even slanting more to working with many of the companies that Damian just presented to you. But a lot of the growth is coming from Chinese kind of municipalities that want to go out and say, we want foreign direct investment to come in. We want to work with global companies. And we're seeing a lot of growth there. So that is what's happening. But Xi'an is here in New Orleans right now at this conference. I'm here with my colleagues, and Chris Gregg works together with me in the public affairs group and has lived in China for 8 years and has been studying Chinese for about the last 15 years. Joe Zhou has worked with me for 15 years, worked with the Ministry of Commerce for 15 years. He was in New York for a period of time, but has really grown our public affairs practices and been a first-rate advisor to many companies in China. So they're together with me here, and Chris is going to share this conversation with me, and Joe is here to answer any questions that you might have as well. The message that we have, and we've been talking to a lot of groups in China around what's happening, or what are our recommendations for succeeding in the public affairs arena in China, are really five different things. One is kind of start with just basic understanding of where you're at in kind of the conversation, and I'll touch on that a little bit. You got to get the messaging right, and we see companies that aren't getting the messaging right that fall into real problems, but messaging really matters and how it's nuanced in China. Defense, there's a growth in kind of issues and crisis management work that we've done, and we'll touch on that a little bit. And then there are still a lot of opportunities, and it's China remains a very significant country for many of our global clients. So we'll talk about that, and then we'll close on engagement. So let me just touch on understanding really quickly. And we talk a lot, I guess, when you're working in the public affairs realm in China, it's important to understand what lens you're speaking through or you're looking through, and what listening to what the other side has to say. And I keep going back to one thing that comes up a lot. Every time a Westerner comes into China, they talk about China as a developed market, and you can see some of that from what Damien presented earlier. Every time someone says that, you'll hear the Chinese say, we're really a developing market. So I asked Chris in our public affairs team to look into the different arguments versus developed and developing, and it comes back a lot. But you really have to understand the lens you're looking at. Now, in this particular case, no one is really right or wrong in this argument. It depends on really what frame you're discussing it through. So, Chris, maybe you can touch on that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. I think this is one of the big issues, in fact, just under the surface in U.S.-China relations right now, and really demonstrates how China, as a growing global power, the world, companies, nation states have to sort of adjust to Chinese narratives and work within that framework. So if you look, so this slide kind of shows China's point of view and the U.S. President Donald Trump's point of view. China goes out of its way to make sure the world knows that it's a developing country. And the West kind of says, well, wait a minute, you've got all these big companies, you've got, you know, all of the world's biggest trading economy, the world's second largest economy. How can you say you're still a developing country and deserve sort of all of these advantages or comparative advantages that come with that in the global trading system? And so we kind of looked at this and said, okay, well, how do you define a developing versus a developed country? And unfortunately, there's no perfect definition for it, but the best proxy is the World Bank's development level, which they call high income. Again, to Damien's earlier comments, China's at about an $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 per capita income level. We puts it in a high middle income, but certainly not in a high income or developed country status. So when you look at it at a macro level, it's definitely still a developing country. But if you look at this map here on the East Coast in the red, this is data from Bloomberg. It shows that 200 million Chinese actually live in a high income country. So it's a lot more nuanced than this. You could say, yes, China is a developing country on the whole, and it's very easy to see how the province of Gansu or Guangxi or elsewhere in China is a developing country. But for the West, increasingly, and I think this is what the heart of the trade frictions and U.S. relationship, U.S.-China relationship are at, is that the developed economies are actually competing with developed economy-like companies from China. So if you're competing with a company from Guangdong or Jiangsu or Zhejiang, these are all much more developed economy levels. And it's unfair in Donald Trump's characterization for China to use the kinds of protectionist economic policies that enable it to play catch up. So it's easy to say that they're right and wrong at the same time, right? In Beijing, you have a $20,000 per capita income puts you well into the developed country level, but out in other parts of China, you're well below that level. So it's really both, and you've got to think, you know, what lens are you looking at this through? You know, understanding that lens how your audience is viewing the situation is really critical to effective communication in China. So this is just kind of one of those examples to demonstrate how different both China and then the outside of China looks at a big issue.
So once we kind of have an understanding of what lens or what the different narratives are in whatever context we're working within, the next thing that we do with a lot of our clients is talk about the messaging and just getting and we've seen a lot of cases where messaging has run amok. And we've seen cases where someone really understands the nuances and gets messaging right. And so the next one, if you were to take a company like KFC, for example, they are hugely successful in China. There have been many books written about KFC. If you go into a KFC, you'll see it's, you know, got a menu that's catered to the Chinese. They, you know, 50%, I think at one point, 50% of KFC's revenues were coming out of China. And many Chinese think that KFC is a Chinese company. I guess that's kind of what helped guide their success there. Adidas is another company that has done an enormous amount of thinking about how they develop product for the Chinese and how they talk about their business there, and has it's really one of the fastest growing regions for them. And then I think a good example, if anybody wants to benchmark who's kind of managing the sensitive dynamic well, I think Apple has done a really good job. And Tim Cook, I've been in several conferences where he's talked about, just explain the importance of the China market, and also talk through the privacy concerns. And so he's kind of balanced well amidst a lot of sensitivities. And the last time he was there, in fact, was a very sensitive time, and he went out and did a lot of work just within the Chinese community. It was less kind of political and more just trying to be accessible to the Chinese consumer. So it's interesting to just look at how they message through those sensitivities. A lot of the companies that have succeeded keep talking about, you know, messages about in China for China. That kind of resonates with what the Xi administration cares about. There's a lot of pharma companies that, when you're doing messaging, we thought about, that the Chinese consumers are entitled to what consumers have all over the world, or access to product that consumers have all over the world, and that matters a lot when it comes to the kind of the accessibility of new pharmaceuticals that are on the market. So this type of sensitized messaging is the second step we usually take in with working with many of our clients. The same is true for Chinese companies that are going to the U.S. They have to understand the dynamics and the context in which they're working within. So
Go ahead.
So we're seeing as China becomes more of a powerful player and more self-confident on the global stage, more and more putting forward their version of political correctness. These are two examples that made headlines in the last year. The Mercedes-Benz, I believe this was actually on their was on their Twitter account or Instagram account, where a quote from the Dalai Lama was posted. And then on the right, JW Marriott had a survey which categorized Chinese regions, Tibet, Hong Kong, Taiwan, as Macau as countries as opposed to part of China. And these are sensitive political issues in China. And we're seeing in just in the last year and recently more and more that companies are being called out on social media by the Chinese by the Chinese state media to abide by sort of China's version of what political correctness is, whether it's sensitive things related to the Dalai Lama or Taiwan or other issues. And related to that is sort of geopolitical. So these are companies that are not offending the Chinese directly, but are related through their home government. So the kind of most classic example of this was Norway's salmon ban after Liu Xiaobo, the sort of human rights democracy advocate, was awarded the Nobel Prize like 10 years ago now, and trying to ban the import of salmon from Norway. So a lot of workers and companies in Norway were impacted by that decision. And again, this past year, Lotte Supermarket, for those of you who don't know, is kind of the Walmart of South Korea, was caught up in a geopolitical situation after agreeing to sell a plot of land to the government that would be used for the deployment of a missile defense system. They were charged with fire code violations all across China. And 80% of their stores were closed. Tourism to Korea dropped. So these are kind of tools that the Chinese state uses in pressuring foreign governments that Western companies aren't as used to, which are taking place with more frequency. And as China grows more powerful, as the market becomes more important, and these sort of differences in economic models and value systems are manifested, these kinds of challenges will increase. And that's just, I think, really exemplified in this Google situation with their Project Dragonfly. For those of you that aren't familiar, it's this kind of top secret plan that Google has had, which is no longer top secret, to launch a censored search engine in China. They, of course, left in 2010, the market in 2010, citing government sort of limits on free speech to their search engine, and are now kind of creeping back in with this experiment, as the CEO put it. And this just kind of underscores that as China grows increasingly powerful and important globally, companies have to play by the Chinese rules, so to speak, and balance their own kind of political interests, geopolitical positioning, and kind of values. We're seeing foreign companies increasingly trying to figure out how to navigate that, trying to figure out how to message when you have stakeholders in different markets at different levels who have pretty different interests, and not forgetting any of those stakeholder groups. With Google, one of the really big ones that launched this was actually their own internal employees who were upset with the situation about how Google was advancing in China. So thinking about all those stakeholder groups and how to message them is increasingly complex as China continues to rise. The fourth section here, talking about opportunities. So despite these challenging times, obviously everybody's familiar with China-U.S. relations and China's kind of increasingly difficult environment to navigate in. That doesn't mean that there aren't still opportunities. So even in technology, which has been famously associated with kind of negative ideas of China's techno-nationalism and indigenous innovation and tech transfer. We've been talking to a lot of our tech clients who see this as a concern but are at the same time quite confident about their ability to protect their IP, working with good partners, having open conversations with the Chinese government, and there's a lot of opportunity here. I mean, the Chinese is putting a lot of money behind it. They do not want to be working with suboptimal platforms or technologies, so those international technologies are still very, very highly valued and appreciated and admired, and China is striving to kind of catch up to and learn from those advanced international companies. And lastly, there's a lot of exciting innovation happening in technology in China, and foreign companies can benefit from, co-innovating, being close to that work that's happening here on the ground. Social priorities. This is not really anything new. As always, the sort of formula for effective government relations, sort of public affairs, is always taking what your company or organization is best at, and aligning it with China's objectives. So bicentennial goals that Damien talked about earlier are really driving a lot of this. But Xi Jinping has made poverty alleviation and healthy living hallmarks of his agenda, and green development is another key kind of social priority. So moving from quantitative to more qualitative metrics for good living, a lot of our clients are working on, messaging, whether it's CSR programs or building it into their business strategies to communicate how they're kind of helping. This is, as Scott talked about, in China for China, how you're helping China to achieve its social priorities. And thirdly, on the opportunity side is this Chinese outbound. We're here today in New Orleans with Xi'an. We have more and more clients, as Scott mentioned, which are Chinese clients that are looking to go global. The Belt and Road is quite a sensitive or controversial initiative, so to speak, in Western countries, and for reasonable reasons, because of debt trap diplomacy or whatever you want to call it. But there's also a lot of positive happening in it too, despite the sort of negative. So figuring out how to be a part of China's outbound investment and benefit from partnering with Chinese companies or working with Chinese companies, there's a lot of advantage there. The one thing worth stressing is Chinese tourism, outbound tourism, which reaches, it's over 100 million now, I think, close to 150 million outbound tourists every year. So increasingly opportunities for foreign companies and foreign markets to get a piece of that outbound pie.
So the last kind of point here is just engagement. And it's always been our philosophy that if we're at the table in discussion, it's important in terms of just, whether it's guiding our clients or helping, the China's, the way in which China interacts with the world. So any chance we get to have them engage with, whether it's companies or other countries, we will usually try to be part of that equation. The next slide. I don't need to talk really about the events of this last week. I think everybody on this call is probably well familiar with what's happening. I mean, how to read the tea leaves has become almost impossible. And what happens, it's kind of we're a tweet away from it going upwards or downwards. So, but we find like the Chinese are much more pragmatic in this approach. But also increasingly less patient. So let's see what happens within the next 90 days. If we were to end this kind of conversation now, it would really be around just we feel like, particularly at this moment in time, it's important to be part of the conversation. Thinking about those five different points we mentioned about, understanding, getting the messaging right, getting your defense up, look for the opportunities, and engaging. Focusing on just kind of prioritizing the issues, because if you try to do too much, you'll get kind of a little bit diluted in your approach. And just, really very careful targeting in terms of who you're trying to target and also what messages you're using. So That's a little bit about what we're seeing. I hope that's helpful, and we're open up for questions, I suppose. So back to you, Dasha.
Thank you so much. Both of the presentations were excellent. I think that, Damien, you did a great job setting us up to know more about the economic situation in the country, and then, Scott, you and your team more the public affairs aspect of things. So we do have a few minutes left, and I would encourage everybody who's on the line to ask Damien and Scott questions that you may have, specifically about their presentations or something that you would like to know more about in the region. I wanted to ask both of you if you have any advice for those working in public affairs on regulatory or issues tracking in China, where those things may not be as transparent as they are in other markets.
Damien, do you want to answer that, or do you want me to take that?
Scott, go ahead, please.
So we do a lot of this. I mean, it's a combination of there are a lot of very smart people like Damien and other kind of government affairs advisors and journalists and analysts that we track, and we try to provide what's out there from a public domain. I mean, this is where my colleague who's sitting next to me, Joe Zhou, comes in, because what we try to do on top of that normally is get a sense for, you know, have conversations with different stakeholders that could bear some understanding on what's happening in the regulatory framework and kind of read the tea leaves a little bit. So part of our practice is really, you know, not only is it what's in the public domain, but supplemented by having conversations with different stakeholders that can help help shape that. And then I kind of have a 3-5 person philosophy. So when I'm trying to figure out what's kind of on the agenda, I will ask probably 3 different people of 3 different walks of life, whether it be a Chinese journalist that's well-connected or a government think tank, to try to get some deeper understanding on what to expect. It's not very clear always. It's not based on kind of what's happened historically. It's based on a number of different factors. So that's usually how we set up that type of work, Dasha, if that helps answer the question.
Yes, I think that's helpful. Thank you. I also wanted to ask if both of you could comment a little bit more on the relationship between business and government in China, just because, Damien, you commented on the fact that private companies versus state companies get different types of attention and different types of favors from the Chinese government. So if maybe you could elaborate a little bit more about that and give us an idea of how that might change in the coming years, I think that would be great.
Sure. The big difference, let me set it up this way. I think I'll make 2 kind of core points. One is I think there's a lot made out of the ownership identity of the firm. You know, I talk a lot about state-owned, the operative word being owned, state-owned enterprise versus privately owned enterprise. In my judgment, I actually think that ownership distinction is not as important as the idea of control. So the government can be a passive a minority investor in a private firm, but if the government entity actually has control of the board, then it doesn't matter if it's a privately owned or a state-owned, and vice versa. Right. I think we in the United States and in the West, we're not used to the idea of state-owned enterprises, so we kind of fixate on ownership, but it's really about control. And the big change is that for about 20 years, I won't go into too many details, but 2 presidents before President Xi Jinping, President Zhang made a big policy where he basically invited private sector capitalists, everybody, to become part of the Communist Party. So Communist Party was essentially the big tent party. They welcomed everybody, entrepreneurs, private sector, so on and so on. But that's been partially reversed under the current President Xi, where he's kind of putting the party back into the corporate side, whether it's private or state-owned, theoretically speaking. And we also need to be clear that there are central state-owned enterprises and there are local government-owned state-owned enterprises. The Chinese government really only cares about the central ones. There are only about 80, 90 of them, but they're huge. They own vast parts of the economy. The local ones, there are about 300, 400,000. Nobody knows the exact number, but there are several hundred thousands of them. Those the government cares less about. They could actually be bought out by private companies. They could be controlled by private, some of them might just, collapse. But definitely under the current government, there's a more state-centric view of that these core central state-owned enterprises must be part of the economy, and they need to be strengthened both in the commercial sense and in the political sense. So one clear fact that came out recently, it turned out that Jack Ma, the former chairman of Alibaba, is actually a Communist Party member. That was not a surprise to most Chinese people. But everybody kind of knew that, but it was explicitly, laid out. But he runs one of the biggest private tech companies, or he used to run one of the biggest private tech companies in China and built it. So it's getting muddied, and it's harder to tell, but I think it's not sufficient to just fixate on the ownership question, but really who controls that firm. How is the board – what is the board composed of? And I think that gives you more clarity about how the company actually operates. So it's more important to look at how the company operates versus who's, who owns what.
Great. Thank you, Damian. We do have one more question, and I think this is a good one for us to end on. So how does Xi's centralization of power impact both China's ability to enact the necessary reforms and how foreign firms should approach doing business?
Scott, do you want to take that, or?
Sure. Do you have a view? We have a view, but Damon, do you want to share, and then we can share a view?
I will just say that I'll just make a very simple point. I think the centralization, and Scott, you may be able to validate this or not, but based on what I've been hearing and talking to people there, it just the centralization in practical terms, in terms of government affairs, in terms of engagement, I think. The government side, the state council side, where all the bureaucracy is, that's become weaker relatively to these new vehicles that President Xi has personally created. He's a big fan of these so-called leading groups. He's created about a dozen of them since he came to power. So he's putting a lot more power into these leading groups and deliberately weakening the state council, which is run by the premier, and that houses all the agencies. Obviously, there's already a relative ranking and power among the agencies, but overall, the centralization has led to different power concentrated in different vehicles, predominantly in the leading groups. So I think engagement with those is probably going to be more important because that's where a lot of decisions are being made.
Yeah, just to supplement that a little bit. So Xi's centralization of power. This sort of favorable view on its impact on China's ability to enact reforms was 5 years ago when he first came to power, the narrative went something like this. China has so many vested interest groups, all these SOEs, these local governments. In order to push through these difficult structural economic reforms that are going to see a lot of those interest groups lose their influence and ability to capture gains from the system, from the growth, we have to centralize power and really push these reforms through. That was the favorable view about 5-6 years ago. That hasn't happened. So it's a question of what Xi's centralization of power does. It basically says what Xi wants to do is what's going to happen, and that's more difficult to read when it's concentrated in a small groups and in Xi Jinping's hands. The second part of the question about how foreign firms should approach doing business in that environment, it's a difficult question, one we struggle with. I think, as Damien alluded to, there are a lot less points of contact with people in the know, or that pretend to be in the know anyway. You know, where in the kind of who, when administration, there was there were more kind of English speaking, more international types of Chinese officials who you could interact with and engage with and get insights from about the direction of things. Much more difficult these days for foreign firms to engage. So, what does that mean? You need to kind of spread your stakeholder engagement into other areas than just the state council. You know, a lot of we've had success with a lot of the academics, kind of the professors and think tank influencers who are quite instrumental in advising the government, have a good sense of, you know, when you're drilling down into the industries or specific technical topics, there's a lot you can do there. Journalists, business organizations, associations. So there's more than just the government stakeholders to focus on. But macro, what it means is that it's much more difficult to get information. Another level of that is not just Xi Jinping's centralization of power, but also his positioning of himself and of China as, you know, this is kind of China's coming out and on the world stage, more influential, more wants more respect globally. And so what that means for foreign companies is also that it's more difficult to get those meetings, you know, to be able to meet with high levels of Chinese government, whereas that used to be, you know, global CEOs at big Fortune 100 firms, it was not so difficult to get high level meetings. Nowadays, much more difficult and much more rare. So, focusing engagement at more focused kind of issue areas and industry areas, finding the right stakeholders is a bit more nuanced.
Well, thank you so much. I think that's a great question for us to wrap up on. And again, I would very much like to thank Damien and Scott and his team for joining us today to offer your perspectives on what public affairs in China looks like and what the outlook is, especially for foreign firms operating in the market. We will be following up with all of the participants with a recording of today's session. We will not be including the slides, but if you need more assistance or more resources on China, please feel free to reach out to me directly. We have a number of resources here at the Council. You can email me at deventicheva@pac.org. So with that, I would like to, again, thank our presenters and thank all of our participants who are on the line with us today. And I would like to wish everybody a festive holiday season, and I hope that we will be connecting again in 2019. So thank you so much, and please feel free to reach out if there's anything I can do for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.